We're on the air. I'd like to open the Committee on Human Services. Thank you for coming today. Looks like we've got a big crowd here. Let's get started. We're going to do a public hearing on Senate Bill 241. Michael, you want this way?
Yeah, I'll just do it from here.
Okay. Would you like to cover what 241 is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 241 establishes certain essential rights of children of incarcerated parents. It establishes a task force on children of incarcerated parents. It requires a task force to submit a report and an implementation plan to the Legislative Assembly by June 30th, 2018, and every year thereafter. The bill sunsets the task force on December 31st, 2021, and it declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Okay, Senator Dimmer.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Chair Olson and colleagues. I'll go ahead and introduce myself for the record, Michael Dembro, Senate District 23, but I'm just going to be here. One of the privileges of being on the committee is I get to look at everyone as I'm testifying, which is great. So this bill, Senate Bill 241, comes out of a task force that was created in 2015, the Task Force on Reentry in Housing and Employment. And you'll remember that in 2015, we passed the Ban the Box legislation to try to make it easier for people who were formerly incarcerated to be successful in their reentry into the outside world. And we knew at that time that the box and the Ban the Box issue was just one obstacle that formerly incarcerated people face when they are trying to get reintegrated into the system. And so we created a task force. I was the chair of the task force together with Senator Winters and then Representative Lou Frederick and Julie Parrish. We were the four legislators on it. We had a number of people from an array of stakeholder backgrounds. And we came up with we were able to identify a number of obstacles that get in the way of successful reentry. And I don't need to tell you how important it is that reentry be successful, because when it's not, you know, if people who were formerly incarcerated find themselves unable to find housing, unable to find employment, unable to find a place for themselves, there's a high likelihood that they're going to reoffend and become a problem rather than potentially a real resource for us all. So one of the obstacles, or rather let me say one of the ways that help formerly incarcerated people to be successful in their reentry is when they have a solid family situation and they have been able to maintain solid relations with their children and with other members of their family. And as we were talking about that, we came to realize how often throughout the encounters with the criminal justice system, the children of incarcerated parents are not really taken into account. Their needs are not taken into account the way that they need to be. That actually, in many ways, the children of incarcerated parents are victims, just as a number of other people are victims. And so it became really important for us to send out a message that we are concerned about the needs of the children of incarcerated parents. And so worked with a group of advocates to create the Bill of Rights, actually, of the children of incarcerated parents. And, of course, we could have just done a Bill of Rights, but what does that mean? I mean, if, you know, once we have set our values, which are there in the Bill of Rights that's in Senate Bill 241, how do we make sure that they're actually followed, that they're actually implemented, that the needs of children are taken into account every step of the process from arrest, you know, through reentry? And so we are, you know, part of Senate Bill 241 is also to bring a group of people together to create an effective implementation strategy so that the Bill of Rights really is incorporated in the day-to-day way that people are thinking about the system. And so you'll hear more about that from, you know, I think you'll hear testimony about the importance of taking into account the children of incarcerated parents, but also next steps about how we can do the implementation of these values, of these principles effectively. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions, or if you want to wait until you hear the further testimony, I'd be happy either way.
Are there any questions from the committee? None. Okay. Thank you very much, Senator Denbrough. I'd like to call up on the first panel Kylie Grunow, Heather Rowlett, and Kelly Ruth. Thank you very much for coming, ladies. And who would like to start? And if when you start, please remember to say who you are.
I'll go first. Good afternoon, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is Kylie Grunow, and I'm here today with the YWCA of Greater Portland. We are very pleased to be testifying in support of Senate Bill 241, which creates a Bill of Rights for children of incarcerated parents. I'm going to be very brief because there are some VIPs sitting behind me who have missed school today to come talk to you about their experiences and why Senate Bill 241 matters to them. So I'm going to primarily speak to a Dash 1 amendment that is coming your way, which essentially gets rid of the task force that is outlined in the bill and would instead assign that same work to the Governor's Reentry Council. I want to say thank you to Senator Denbrough's office, to the Governor's office, and to the Department of Corrections for really identifying that existing body that could take on this work and really has the stakeholders of different agencies that are meant to think about how do we really take into consideration the rights of these children who are impacted through no fault of their own. So I'm going to be, like I said, I'm going to be brief. If you have questions, I'm happy to answer them more, but I know that Kelly is also going to offer some comments about that amendment.
Thank you. Whoever would like to go next.
Great. Well, with that, I will speak next. My name is Kelly Rass. I am an administrator in the Office of Policy and Business Management for the Oregon Department of Corrections, and I am here today to testify, as Kylie had mentioned, and answer any questions. In 2001, the Oregon Legislature approved Senate Bill 133, putting into law the Children of Incarcerated Parents Project Work Group. The Department of Corrections played a significant role in that work group and implemented many of its recommendations, including family-oriented visiting spaces, the use of technology to enhance connectivity, and the establishment of the Parenting Inside Out classes. Since that time, the Governor's Reentry Council was established in 2007. In 2014, the Governor's Reentry Council convened 7 implementation teams, including the Family and Community Connections Engagement Team, of which I am a chair, alongside a colleague from the Department of Human Services. In light of recent conversations with the Governor's Reentry Council and other stakeholders, we have agreed to amendments that will remove language establishing the task force. DOC and the Governor's Reentry Council are committed to working on these issues within the Council's existing structure. The Department appreciates the stakeholders in their glorious colors today who have worked on this issue, and we are pleased that this issue from back in 2001 continues to be before you and before the citizens of the state of Oregon.
Hello, my name is Heather Rowlett, and I am the project coordinator for the Family Preservation Project. Prior to acquiring my dream job, I was a family and crisis therapist in the community. I was a Multnomah County TAE clinician, a transition age youth clinician, and I was also a coach and trainer at the Regional Research Institute for Human Services. I am also the child of a formerly incarcerated individual, and I aged out of foster care. I was drawn to this work because I not only personally understand the importance of supporting families and their children, parents and their families during incarceration, but because I've seen the benefit that resources can have in communities that are largely criminalized due to poverty and lack of access to social capital. When I review Senate Bill 241, I consider these rights as inalienable human rights. The growth of the children of Oregon into leaders and sustainers of tomorrow is a public health issue. The mental and physical health of every single child should be a paramount concern, and when necessary, we should come together to best support their development with careful measures of meeting their needs, addressing their concerns and fears, and providing what we know and has been proven to improve the human condition. Every day with the mothers at Coffee Creek, I tell them that the only thing that separates our lives is sheer luck, that I am not special, that I did nothing they too could not have done with the assistance I was given, but instead it was purely luck. I was fortunate to be supported by professionals, coaches, and mentors throughout my early life who provided the resources and guidance I was not receiving at home. Because of this, my goal has always been that no matter how far I go or what success I find, how well I fit in with people whose lives I do not understand, that I will never forget where I came from. And this is important to me solely because I know that if we were to properly invest resources into all children, other people like me would have had a chance. I'm here today because I believe in Oregon. I grew up in the Pacific Northwest, and I love this state with every fiber of my being. And considering that we are already a leader in the forefront of social issues and equitable legislation, I'm excited to see what is to come as we continue to strive together to improve the lives in our communities. I ask that you hear the following children and their parents as they express to you the difference it would make if only we listened. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Well, good, I have one.
Just kidding.
Okay, hang on.
They didn't hear you say you had
one. Oh, I have one. Kelly, this is for you, and I asked Kylie this before. In the bill itself, it talks about to speak with, see, and touch the incarcerated parent. How is DOC going to handle that in cases where, you're not allowed to touch an inmate? How are you going to get over that? I'm just for my own curiosity.
Yeah, Chair Olson, I think it's an excellent question and one that we discussed. When you review the clauses at the beginning, it certainly speaks to these actions being in the best interest of the child. On occasion, and we imagine it will be a rare occasion, there could be folks in our custody for whom they are not currently in a space of safety to be interacting with physically their children. And so we would staff each of those cases is what we anticipate.
Thank you, and I'll do just one follow-up. And don't take this as a crass question, but it's a question I think needs to be asked. How do you ascertain and make certain that a child will not bring in things into the prison that shouldn't be brought in?
Sure, Chair Olson and the rest of the members of the committee, that is a question that we also ask ourselves every day, and currently in probably almost all 14 of our facilities are processing folks through our system. So it's an issue that we deal with already on a very regular basis with hundreds, if not thousands, of children coming into our facility each month. And I hope that we have done well in doing that, and we feel confident that we have, so we would continue the security practices as established.
Thank you very much. It was an important question to me, and I apologize if it offended anyone, but the fact is that there is the possibility, and I just want to make sure DOC was prepared for it. Thank you. Thank you very much. Next, I'd like to see Sophia Montoya. Selena Lasky and Marco Brewer. Marco, since we're just going to let you go last, young lady, would you like to go first?
Okay.
All right. Ma'am, you're up then.
Okay.
And please announce who you are.
My name is Celine Lasky. I have the right to be informed of my mom's arrest in an age-appropriate matter. I was 6 when my mom went away. All I heard was how bad of a person my mom was. I thought that meant I was a bad person too. I needed a grown-up to tell me my mom loved me because she wasn't allowed to. Nobody asked me what I wanted, and when they did ask me, they didn't listen to me. I needed a grown-up to listen to me. My mom will always be my mom, no matter what happens. Today, I get to see my mom, and I want other kids to be able to see their moms, too.
Thank you very much. Sophia, are you ready? Go for it.
Okay
not a problem. Not a problem. Marco, would you like to go, please?
Yes. My name is Marco Brewer, and I'm 17, and I just wanted to briefly say my story. I wrote it down prior to saying it so I don't blank. Anyway, I have the right to not be judged, labeled, or blamed for my mom's incarceration. I'm the son of Noah Sweet, who was incarcerated when I was 11, and my sister was 4. We were fortunate to move in with my grandma, but I know a lot of kids aren't fortunate enough. We're here today advocating for a Bill of Rights for children of incarcerated parents, and the right that hits me the hardest is I have the right not to be judged, labeled, or blamed for my mom's incarceration. Unfortunately, for the first while of my mom's incarceration, I didn't have this right. I went to school with many people that would bring up my mom's situation and trigger me with it. I needed help from teachers and counselors that I wasn't given and that many other kids aren't given today. This fueled lots of anger within me, and within the first few months of my mom's incarceration, I was suspended 3 or 4 times and served over 30 detentions. People said I would be just like my mom, and I began to believe that. Fortunately, my mom joined the Family Preservation Project, which gave me the closest thing to this Bill of Rights. Through years of that, I became a better man with a more stable family. Today, I stand here with a 3.75 GPA, and I'm the number one ranked offensive lineman in Oregon, and I have 2 full-ride scholarships to Division I schools. I tell you this because if I can accomplish this with the help I received, imagine what kids could do with the help of this Bill of Rights. Thank you. And remember, it's our parents who made a mistake and who messed up, not us.
Thank you. Sophia?
My name is Sophia.
Could you move the microphone over to her? Thank you very much. There you go.
My name is Sophia Montoya. I had the right to be protected from additional trauma at the time of my mom's arrest. I was 3 years old when my mom went away. What I needed was grown-ups to help me understand what was happening. What I wanted was a hug from my mom, but that didn't happen. What I really wanted was somebody to help my mom get better. I'm here because I want to make it better for other kids.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions of this panel? I'd like to say to you, Marco, congratulations.
Thank you.
And good luck in your football career.
Thank you.
Hope you do well. Matter of fact, let's see you in the pros. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming. Kendra Wright, Nova Sweet, and Stacey Ayers. Kendra, would you like to go first?
Absolutely. Good afternoon, members of the committee. My name is Kendra Wright. My daughter is Celine Lasky. I'm a participant with FPP and I'm a graduate of their program. I've been out of prison for 19 months now. Today, I am an active part of my daughter's life. I get to see her often, clearly. I go to school full-time, and I work at a detox center full-time. My child had the right to be cared for in my absence in a way that prioritized her physical, mental, and emotional needs. Instead, 2 months after my incarceration, my parental rights were terminated based on numerous reasons, lack of availability for treatment and the option to parent her every day. I decided to appeal that termination, and in doing so, my DHS worker prohibited me any contact with my daughter. During that time, my daughter was unaware of what was going on. All she knew is she couldn't talk to mom or see mom. As a result, my grandmother would find her often crying in closets. She would get phone calls from teachers about my daughter crying because kids were talking about their moms and dads, and it just triggered an emotion in her. It wasn't until I joined FPP that I actually had the opportunity to talk to my daughter and finally get to start seeing her. It took 18 months. From the moment of my arrest, I was helpless when it came to my daughter. I had no one to advocate for me or my daughter. Because of my choices, my daughter suffered. I needed the support and advocacy of other adults that wasn't available. We lost each other for 18 months, and to my daughter, that was a huge devastation. She was very introverted, a very sad child. Upon seeing me and rebuilding our relationship, she then became extroverted and joined dance and talent shows and was a star hula hooper. now she's into hip hop and ballet. And I just urge you to support Senate Bill 241, and I am committed to doing whatever it takes to make sure that other children and their parents don't have to go through what we went through.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Nova, please.
Hi, my name is Nova Sweet. I'm a FPP graduate, former inmate at Coffee Creek Correctional Facility, huge advocate for reentry and anything else that's going to help pay it forward and give back to a community that's given so much to myself. I wasn't originally going to speak today because I'm always bugging you guys, but two of the moms and kids are still in traffic, so I'm up here speaking. You guys have the rights in front of you. We just feel like all kids in the state of Oregon should have these rights, whether their parent is a mom or a dad or whomever, that these kids should be treated just like any other child that's dealing with a death or a loss of a loved one. We have all sorts of wraparound and crisis services that help those children, but not for incarceration because there's too much stigma attached to it right now. So I'd like to get rid of that. To answer your questions about physically touching your parent. Currently in jails across the state of Oregon, they're moving to just video visits, and that's purely because of ease of visits. It doesn't have to do with the fact that you have a parent that's been abusing a child and there's some sort of risk to their best interest. It's because it's what the jails are doing to make it easier for them. We don't think that's okay. There's ways to have contact visits with attorneys or clergy people. There should be a way to have contact with your child if it's in their best interest. So it's not just about the Department of Corrections and how they're doing this. In addition to that, as far as bringing in contraband, that's absolutely a risk. And every parent that's in FPP that has a contact visit with their child gets strip searched. It's the reality of it. You just know that that's what's going to happen. There's also random drug testing that they do. And every single one of our kids, from babies on up, have to walk through that metal detector. I forgot to mention my son is Marco and my daughter is Malik. So anyways, that was supposed to be the beginning. The other part is that just like we hold each other accountable out here and doing the next right thing and we all come together to tell you guys how important this is, that's the same way it happens inside. When you find a group of like-minded moms that want to do something better, we don't allow each other to bring crap in. And that's better than any security guard can ever make sure that the institution is safe. We're not willing to risk it. Thank you.
Thank you. Sure.
Vice Chair Olson, or Chair Olson today, I guess. Yeah?
Members
of the committee, my name is Stacey Ayers, and I am the Child Protective Services Program Manager. I work at the Department of Human Services, and thanks for the opportunity to talk with you today. Just really briefly, we're familiar with the legislature or the bill. There are a couple of issues that we would like to see kind of ironed out. I think a couple of them were talked a little bit about today so far. And one in particular is the right of the child is an absolute right. And but I wonder, one of the concerns we would have is there ever a situation where a crime that has been committed against a child, for instance, sex abuse, or some other type of criminal behavior toward a child, could still how that would affect this right. And there would be times potentially where it may not be in the best interest of the child, and they would still want to see the parent in those situations. And so just something that we would want to be thinking about a little bit as this potentially moves through. And then the other issue, and it gets into the visitation right, is kind of what that looks like. If a child wants to see their parent, which they probably would every day and the child's in department custody, is that a possibility? Is that realistic? And I would say that it's probably not. And we would do what we could, hopefully, and I imagine there are probably people in the room today who had a different experience than this, but we should be trying to facilitate those visits and that contact. But the means right now within the department are not such that we could meet the needs of the child, on a daily basis, or potentially even on a weekly or every 2 weeks basis. It's not there, and so I just want to make those concerns known to the committee, and I'm happy to answer any other questions.
Are there any questions?
Yeah, I do.
Senator Dimmer.
Thank you. Thanks for that, Stacey. Actually, before I respond to your question, I just want to say, since Kendra and Nova are here, they came to many of our task force meetings, and even though they weren't on the task force, they were real solid contributors, and the whole packet of recommendations that came out of the task force was, a lot of it was informed by them, and I just want to thank them for that. To Stacey's point, so the goal here is this is a Bill of Rights, and just as, the Bill of Rights that's in our Constitution, like the right to free speech, there are limits, and, it depends, that will vary depending on the situation. Fortunately, the Constitution doesn't spell out every single constraint or situation that's left up for interpretation, and that's what we see the purpose of this group that's going to be meeting. These are our goals, that to the extent practicable and possible, the child's needs and desires will be met. That's our starting point. But obviously there are going to be sort of real-world constraints on that, and that's why it's important to have people who work in this world, people from the different agencies, from nonprofits, from children's advocacy groups, et cetera, to try to figure out, okay, so how do we make these values reality on an everyday basis? And so that's, I think that's what this legislation's all about.
Thank you.
Nova, would you like to say something?
Yes, Nova Sweet. So, yes, it's a guiding principle, breathable document that's going to not just impact the Department of Corrections, but the whole state of Oregon. Currently, there's no policies in place with our police that have, at the time of arrest, asked them or instruct them to ask a person if they're a parent. Is there a child at home that needs somebody to call? There's no policy in place that does that. So you hear these horror stories of kids that are taking care of younger siblings because nobody ever knew to ask the question. We need to get the conversation moving, which is why this Bill of Rights is essential.
Thank you. Nova and Kendra, I'd like to commend you on your work on this effort. And as the good senator said, you weren't in the committee, but your work has obviously paid off. And thank you very much for that.
Thank you.
Are there any other discussions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 241, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 242. Matt, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 242 appropriates monies from the general fund to the Department of Administrative Services for the YWCA of Greater Portland for use in the Family Preservation Project. It declares emergency and is effective on July 1st, 2017. There is a sub-referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee, and there is a fiscal impact on the bill and a no revenue impact statement on the bill. And the fiscal impact has been uploaded to OLS.
Thank you very much. The first panel will be Susan. Pardon me.
Can I just say something?
Certainly.
Yeah.
I guess we don't have a first panel. It's Senator Deborah.
Yeah, you can come up in a sec. But I just wanted to sort of kick it off. Again, Michael Dembro from District 23. That's Northeast, Southeast Portland. This is another bill that came that comes out of the task force, and it, as we were talking about the importance of family relations and maintaining those family relations, the first thing that comes to mind is the Family Preservation Project, because it's done such really great work at Coffee Creek. Unfortunately, it's never had stable funding, and each biennium, we've had to come forward with another allocation, and we're still there. And that's what this bill is doing. It's basically putting in a funding request to allow the Family Preservation Project to be preserved, and we would hope actually to expand, because I think, as you'll hear, there is great need out there. And, you know, actually in work that ought to be done at all of our facilities. But I want to just turn it over to the YWCA, which has really taken the lead on the Family Preservation Project, and thank them for their good work there. And I think you'll really appreciate what you hear about this project.
Pamela, are there any questions for Senator Dimbrew? Anybody want to grill him? Who'd like to go first, Jessica or Susan?
I will. Susan Stoltenberg, Executive Director of the YWCA. And thank you, Senator Dimbrough, for your more than a decade of work on this topic. And thank you to the brave people who were here today, telling their story, telling their children's story, and telling the story of the need for the Family Preservation Project. We're going to start. Are we starting with the video? We're going to start with the video that briefly describes the program.
I felt I had failed her so much that any contact with me would be more pain for her. I thought she was better off without me.
I have this thing of wanting to be bottled up and not wanting to let anybody in or know anything about me, and that was something I had to let go. That means opening up and sharing stuff like this.
Somehow you just steered down the wrong path, but I don't think it's intentional. Nobody intentionally wants to screw up their life.
I want to be somebody that my son looks at and he's like, my mom went through some really bad stuff, but look at her. I want to be that person that is the success story.
We've made our mistakes and we are trying to move forward in life.
I don't think society realizes that when they send a mother to prison, they send the entire family.
You know, when those children come, you see your hope again. You see your life again.
Now that she's seen that I'm here and I love her, it's so funny because she looks to me for more things now.
I love you, Mom.
I love you, too.
Go down to the PowerPoint. I guess that was more fun. Go to slideshow. No, up to the top, to the right. There. And go from beginning. There. Thank you. We just finished this morning, so thank you for your patience.
Obviously, you just drove it down here, too. We just saw that.
You didn't see the police lights, I guess. You want to go ahead and go? Do you want to trade places and I'll click? Or just click through? So we're here to talk about continued funding for the Family Preservation Project. The size of the issue is significant since between 2000 and 2011, the number of women incarcerated in Oregon for property crimes doubled, and the length of sentence for property and drug crimes has also been going up, despite the fact that violent crime offenses have gone down, as have the punishment. 85% of incarcerated women in Oregon are mothers. 77% of them are in need of some kind of mental health treatment, and 41% have severe mental health problems. That is a big contrast to the male population, where 53% as opposed to 77% need treatment, and only 14% have severe and persistent mental illness. In addition, the population can be characterized as those living in poverty and with all of its associated issues such as addiction, homelessness, and mental illness. custodial parents are more likely, far more likely to be women than men. And so families are affected, of course, by any parent's incarceration, but particularly by a custodial parent or a mother. The obvious costs that begin for a woman who's incarcerated are the court fees and costs, the loss of financial support she's been providing her family, medical expenses, cost of staying, connected through the expense of visits, phone calls, which can cost upwards anywhere between $3 and $5 for 15 minutes, costs of commissary for things such as personal hygiene items. But perhaps the greatest expenses are those incurred following incarceration and for the long term. Children pay. They're more likely to fail or drop out of school, experience themselves mental health issues or drug addiction. They're more likely to be involved with the juvenile justice and to have a life. Wait a minute. Go back. Sorry. Lifelong. 40% of all children in foster care have at least one parent who's incarcerated. And altogether, that's about 7,000 children, which is about 10% of the children who are incarcerated, of the children who have an incarcerated parent in Oregon today. So 9 out of 10 children are not coming to the attention of any authorities. Those are the kids who are living with the stigma in school, who are afraid to talk to people, who have no resources to help them get through these challenging times with in safety, with enough food, avoiding homelessness. Treatment for mental health and medical treatment, 73% of all formerly incarcerated parents are in need of medical treatment and mental health treatment. 66% of all children who've lived in a family with an incarcerated member will have chronic health problems. This is a public health issue. This is not a Department of Corrections issue. Joblessness, 67% of all incarcerated people 5 years later are still unemployed or underemployed. They're living in poverty and it's resulting homelessness. You may know that a history of a felony means that you are ineligible for subsidized housing, Section 8 housing, and yet we're surprised when former felons find themselves homeless again. They can't get a job, as Senator Dembrough so articulately said, can't get a job, can't get housing, and then, lo and behold, the most expensive thing is recidivism, not just of the incarcerated person, but generationally. And all of these issues disproportionately affect women because the women are the ones who end up, even if the man, the father is incarcerated, they're the ones who have to pay for the visits, they're the ones who end up homeless, they're the ones who have lost the income. So, and women of color especially.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, committee members, and thank you, Senator Dembrough, for your leadership on both of these bills. My name is Jessica Cass. I'm the director of the Family Preservation Project. And over the course of my work in the prison system over the past 16 years, I have seen firsthand the consequences to the children left behind. Susan mentioned the pathways that lead women to prison, including poverty, addiction, mental illness, and heavy trauma loads. Rather than their mother's incarceration being the pivotal traumatic event for children, it is often the culmination of a series of traumatic events. Though I would propose that there are far better alternatives to criminalizing poverty and addiction and mental illness, and will continue to work towards those solutions, we are in the midst of a crisis. Our state has budgeted $19 million over the next biennium to open a second prison for women because the one prison for women is overcrowded. And while we work towards more sane and solvent solutions, we need to also safeguard those currently being affected. At a minimum, we need to recognize that incarceration creates an interruption, and that this interruption creates an opportunity to identify children we know to be living in risk. To lose one's liberty and be separated from the people that you love is a high-stakes game. It's far too high-stakes a game to not take every opportunity to change the trajectory and interrupt the cycle. The cost of doing nothing is high. And there is, however, a strong return on investment in prevention and intervention. Doing something changes the course for our children. Through its investment in the Family Preservation Project, the state has demonstrated its commitment to making this investment. When we were before you 2 years ago, before the Oregon State Legislature, we were here discussing the Family Preservation Program, which at the time was this circle here. We served 12 moms intensively, 25 children, their caregivers. The return on the investment since the YWCA of Greater Portland has taken leadership and stewardship over the program, the project has been able to actually meet the real needs of incarcerated women in Oregon. And I don't have time to go through every slide, but you have copies of these that you can look through. Essentially, the project operates on one side of the facility and does not discriminate against anybody who needs help or services in real time. There is a responsive project program, tier of the program, that will attempt to meet any need of a mother who's incarcerated at Coffee Creek on the minimum side, which is where we physically are located. 84% of incarcerated mothers had at least one child living with them before incarceration. We often get asked the question, why just mothers? Why not dads too? We absolutely honor the importance of dads in children's lives. Our focus on mothers is structural in nature and due to the fact that most women were the custodial parent prior to going away, which means that the consequences to their children involve changing homes possibly multiple times, changing schools possibly multiple times, and that's why the focus on women. Also, children of incarcerated mothers are 2.5 times more likely to also become incarcerated in their lifetime than if their father is incarcerated. Lastly, connectivity with family is proven by science to be a very key indicator of success. The impact of the Family Preservation Project in the last 18 months since the program got a new life, thank you to the Oregon State Legislature, FPP has saved the state $300,000 in foster care expenses. The efforts of keeping families put together during this big interruption and disruption prevents kids from needing to go into the system. FPP is having a positive impact on the state's women prison population, and the associated cost of incarceration have been reduced as a result. Children of Family Preservation Project participants are performing well on academic indicators like school attendance and reading at grade level. With your investment of $400,000, the legislature has ensured that fewer children are being placed in foster care, incarcerated mothers are less likely to recidivate, and children of participants are exhibiting successful outcomes academically, socially, behaviorally, and emotionally. This investment has created safer communities and relieves the strain on the state resources by interrupting intergenerational criminal justice involvement.
A question often arises, why did the YWCA take on the Family Preservation Project 2 years ago? Our mission at the YWCA is to eliminate racism, empower women, and promote peace, justice, freedom, and dignity for all. I think from what we've shown you so far, that Family Preservation Project's activities and passion are right where we live on all three of those issues. In addition, we have brought numerous resources to bear and allowed, it has given Jessica, frankly, time. We're working on a second film that talks about the experience of a mother's incarceration through the eyes of a child. The film Mothering Inside, which you saw a trailer of, has received national and international accolades. We were featured in Yes magazine as Oregon's top solution to problems. And I think we spent time talking about problems, but what I want to talk about today is the opportunity. I think Oregon has the opportunity through the combination of 241 and 242 to take the lead nationally, to build on the excellence that we have achieved through this funding in the past, to allow the Y to bring additional resources, both in kind and cash, to the table, and for Oregon to take the lead in how we support families as they face a parent's incarceration. I heartily request that you recommend that while it costs $600,000 per biennium or $300,000 a year, we are only asking the same amount we had from 2015 to 17 in recognition of the tight budget challenges the state has. But as we've seen in other tight economic times, the time is no better than now to be working to reduce recidivism rates and improve the lives of children during tough times in our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next panel up is Ebony Howard, Mimi Clinton, and Ashley Doherty. Nice shirts. You guys all shop at the same place?
They got a deal.
I'm bulk.
Who would like to start?
Okay, I'll start.
Ebony?
My name is Ashley Doherty.
And, okay, Ashley.
And good afternoon, committee members. Thank you for listening to us. And my daughter is Sophia Montoya. I'm not sure if you could tell. And I got the doll now. So I was a participant in the Family Preservation Project, the intensive program. And I got out of prison about 2.5 years ago. And now I'm going to school full time. I'm almost done with my associate's degree, and I work full-time, and I have a very, very amazing relationship with my daughter. My daughter and I, I get to take her to acro. She loves her acrobatics. I'm blessed to take her out of school so she can come and talk to share, you know, and to help more kids because of what FPP did for me. The difference that FPP made in my life is immense. Among so many aspects, it restored my sense of dignity, which was completely demolished by the time I got to prison. And by the time I got done with dealing with being told I was going to lose my daughter, you know, DHS wanted to terminate my rights, and I had no way of, you know, knowing how to go through that system. And with the help of FPP, I still have my parental rights. I still get to be a big part of her life. She went to live with strangers, and she was a very young child at that time, and it was very traumatic. And because of this program, you know, we got support from other people who understood. And I got help with navigating the system so that I didn't have to give up my rights, because I knew that wasn't what was best for my daughter, whether or not they were telling me it was. One piece that I definitely feel like we need to highlight is that not only are we all supportive inside in the program, but like we've all been out like a variety of time, and look at us, we're all still standing together because we saw how amazing this program affected our lives and our children's lives and our families' lives, and we just want it to keep going because, you know what, everything that it gave to us, we want to be able to give back too. And we are all still active and supported through FPP, and it's just a beautiful thing. Thank you.
Thank you. Mimi?
Hi, my name is Mimi Clinton. Good afternoon, committee members. I also participated in the FPP Intensive Core Program with my son, Jack Casey, who is not here today. And when I went to prison, I've been out for about 1.5 years, and when I went in, I was his sole guardian, and he was 2, and it was extremely difficult letting go of that relationship to come and serve time for my mistakes. And as a young child, obviously you don't understand why you can't have your mommy. And I was at Coffee Creek for I think about 1 year before I got into FPP, and while at FPP we were able to work through, you know, all the confusion, and I was able to find ways to explain, you know, what had happened and that, you know, this wasn't his fault, and in a way kind of ease his mind so that he didn't have to hold on to that shame. And we were able to connect and bond in a way that would have been impossible through visiting and visitation. Today, it's like no time has passed, and that is all because of FPP. I mean, I am his everything. I mean, I volunteer in his classroom. I work, and my work schedule allows me to basically just be full-time mommy during the week and work on the weekends. And, you know, FPP taught me how to use this experience, this mistake that I made, and grow, and it gave me the confidence and support that I needed to flourish as a human being. And I can honestly say today that, you know, I'm proud of who I am, and my son is proud of who his mommy is, and that's a miracle. So, thanks.
Thank you. Ebony?
My name is Ebony Howard, and I participated in a component of FPP, which is a Family Resource Center, and I did three years on a four-year sentence at Coffee Creek. The first year I had absolutely no contact with my son, but through the Family Resource Center I was able to find an outlet for my voice and be able to begin establishing visitation with my child. My son has special needs, so he's hearing impaired, so phone calls weren't an option, and he was in out-of-home placement. FPP made a huge difference in the relationship with my child. I was facing termination going into prison. There was 8 different potential adoptive placements, and each one fell through for one reason or another. They were wanting to terminate my rights. 8 months before I was released, I got that termination and the path of getting my rights terminated overturned, so it was returned to parent for my son. He'll be moving back home in a month and a half. I've been out 10 months, 3 weeks, and 1 day today. I work full-time as a certified recovery mentor, helping other women avoid the pitfalls that I found myself in, and hopefully use my experience to support and encourage those that are starting a new road to recovery and getting their lives back on track. I'm here today because FPP is a definite life-changing program. For women who find themselves incarcerated, you're in the deepest, darkest hole, and you've given up on yourself, and to have every single tie severed, FPP was that candle flicker in the dark that gave me something to focus on to pull myself up out of those detrimental life choices and consequences. And today I'm on a completely different path. I also tutor GED students, so I'm definitely committed to helping women move forward with their lives, and this program is a very big part of that. So.
Thank you. Are there any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. And next we'll have Carol Sweet, Glenn Doherty, and Adrian Ox. Did I pronounce that right?
Oaks.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Carol, would you like to start?
Sure. And I'll promise you I'm probably going to be the first person up here to cry. So, my name's Carol Sweet. Senator Geisler, I'm in your district. Nova is my daughter, who I'm extremely proud of, Malik and Marco. I was lucky when this happened with Nova. I had the resources that my grandchildren could stay with me. We were able to work through some of the legal details to make sure that they were safe and taken care of. Marco spoke to some of the difficulties in that first year, and he was very angry, and I struggled to know how to help these kids, and then FPP came into our lives. If you've not ever had the experience of taking children or your grandchildren to a prison to visit their mother, I wish I could just, you know, flip a little switch and have you live in that moment for just a few minutes. It's a very difficult thing to do. I mean, you keep the best face, you put the best foot forward, you always are there to support them, to make sure they know how much their mother loves them and that you're doing this to keep the family together. But it's a very sterile environment, and it can be very, just all the way across the board, you can leave there feeling just tremendous sadness, because there's so little contact. You know, you sit at a table, you can barely touch each other, you have guards looking at you all the time. I personally often said afterwards, why do I feel like I'm the one that did something wrong? You know, I don't get that. I don't get that feeling, but I understood very much as you look around those rooms that you just have this sense of this needs to be different. It needs to change. And it changed for us when NOVA was able to be part of the Family Preservation Project. They gave us the opportunity for the kids to go inside the facility and be with their mom and sit on the floor and talk and laugh and touch. For Malik, who was only 5 at the time, I truly believe that was life-saving for her relationship with her mother, because there was she just didn't understand. With Marco, he was older, he was more in his head about it, but that too allowed him to know we were going to be okay. I'm not following my script, but I didn't think about this part really, Nova, but it is true that they also allowed me to work through my anger. Because you don't expect your daughter to go to prison. You don't expect those things to happen in your life, but it did. And they gave me the ability also to work through that with her. And ultimately, that could do nothing but benefit my grandchildren. I can't urge you enough to continue to support this program. It saves lives. And one last thing I'll say. At Thanksgiving this year, our biological family, and there's a bunch of us, everybody had different plans. One of Nova's FPP friends, a woman in Portland, invited us to come have Thanksgiving with their family, a very large family. And the group of women and their families in this room, I love them. They have given so much to us. And it is so true. They stick together. And you just can't put a price on that. So thank you.
Thank you, Adrian.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Adrian Oakes, and I serve with the Oregon Commission for Women, where we advocate for all women in the state of Oregon. We strongly support Senate Bill 242. In fact, I was the lead author on our testimony. I hope you take the time to read it. As the Oregon Commission for Women, we certainly realize the impact of maternal incarceration, not only on the mothers, but on the children as well. The wraparound services that are provided by the FPP, we know are quite beneficial. We've seen in the presentation that they serve to reduce recidivism, but they also increase the quality of lives for the children in terms of academic, social, physical, psychological as well, those impacts. We again wholeheartedly support Senate Bill 242 under the direction and leadership of the YWCA. Thank you.
Thank you. Glenn.
Well, good afternoon, committee. My name is Glenn Doherty. Ashley's my daughter. Sophia's my granddaughter. That's pretty much how I can stick to this. in the beginning, you know, when the FPP means what it says, family preservation, you know, and it kept us all together. We weren't able to keep Sophia with us because of previous silliness I had a Dewey. So, okay, we couldn't keep her. So we went through that a little bit, and when Ashley got into the FPP program, everything started coming together. It worked out nice. There's family meetings, family and child. We all got together. It was, you know, people were on that side, we're on this side, and then after that, it became really nice. We come in just as caregivers. We can drop the child off for visits with their mom. We can go down to the little building they had where all the other family, you know, caregivers can sit, meet, talk, and chat. There's a little group. We all got to know each other. And I can understand, you know, if anybody here say, yeah, let's go get together. And it would be like a big family. But yeah, without the FPP program, it was really difficult for my child to get help. And just going through the rules of knowing who to call, who not to call, how to call, or even getting the time to make a call to these people that they needed help with to keep their child, their parental rights, or even ours. So it was really good for her to be in the program. Thanks. See, the caregivers are good. Help here to keep this program together. It sure helps.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify on Senate Bill 242? Yes. Do you mind? Well, it's not my fault. They told me there'd be 1 minute speeches. I just want to give you a heads up. I'm in trouble because we're behind a little bit.
I'm going to be very
If you could, please, I'd really appreciate it. And your name, please.
My name is Beth Melnick. I wasn't going to testify, but I've been a big fan of FPP for a long time. I'll just read you the letter that I wrote that I figured because I wasn't going to testify. First, I want to thank the committee for their diligent service in navigating complex and challenging issues on behalf of our state. I'm writing in support of the Family Preservation Project. The cycle of intergenerational incarceration is statistically a well-established fact. The Department of Corrections and the foster care system have unintentionally become the symbiotic parts of an entrenched machine dependent upon our children to sustain itself. All this at great cost to the taxpayer. It is a punitive thing that punishes not only those who've broken the law, but their children as well. By restorative therapy, education, and support, the Family Preservation Project successfully interrupts the cycle of feeding the children of inmates into the prison system. I believe the legislature should throw everything they can behind this program, which is currently extending various services to 100 inmates and their families. Women in prison have, on average, 2.5 children and other family members who are affected. In many cases, the women are first-time offenders, and they have public and other needs, public health needs. Family Preservation Project is preventative medicine for our society, which has saddled the DOC and other agencies with illnesses with which it is not designed to deal. Family Preservation Project is the ounce of prevention to the very expensive pound of cure we all pay at the expense of the lives of our next generations. I believe the Family Preservation Project can, in the same progressive tradition as the Oregon system and the bottle bill, serve as a template in other states for breaking the wasteful cycle of intergenerational incarceration. These are uncertain times. For those who need the services provided by our government, times are always uncertain at best. As citizens with good intentions, it is hard to know where to put our attention and support. Of all the many worthwhile causes in need of help, I have chosen to support the Family Preservation Project with my limited time, my money, and my voice. I hope you will choose to fight for it as well.
Thank you very much. I will close. Yes,
Mr. Can I just say one thing? I neglected to say it when I opened. I can't not acknowledge the hard work of our former colleague Chip Shields pushing this program further. There are many women in this room who would not have been able to experience FPP if it wasn't for Chip, and just want to acknowledge that.
Well, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 242.
Do you want to open up a work session on it?
Pardon?
You want to open up a work session on it?
Yeah, you're the boss.
Well, go ahead, open up a work session on it.
We're going to do it?
Yes.
We'll open a work session on Senate Bill 242.
All right, Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Gelser moves Senate Bill 242 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So moved.
Thank you.
You want to do
that was good news.
Yeah. It's not ready.
It's still
right. And I think 241 is still waiting for an amendment, so we'll bring that back as soon as the amendment comes back on 241.
Thank
all right.
You so much.
Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
You got to sell those shirts, too.
I just emailed Lloyd Freeman.
Okay, that sounds good. So let's just do the work sessions really quickly. Lori Freeman from Legislative Council is on her way over to answer everyone's questions on 949. But let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 102.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 102 creates an adoption applicable child savings fund separate from the general fund for the deposit of adoption applicable child savings for later use in accordance with federal funds spending rules. It requires deposited funds to supplement child welfare programs. It declares emergency and is effective on passage. There is a referral, sub-referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. And there is a fiscal statement issued, and, which is on OLUS, and in a statement of no revenue impact.
And colleagues, we heard this a while ago. This is a bill that we need to be in compliance with federal law.
Yeah, I have no memory of this.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 102 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 102 to the floor with a due pass recommendation that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none. So ordered, and 102 is on its way. And do we have Lori here? Okay. So we're going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 949. Colleagues, this is the bill that we heard last week about non-competes, and you had asked to have counsel come and answer some questions about why this industry and how it works.
Yeah, this one.
So, Lori, welcome.
Thank you. Senator Gelser, members of the committee, Lori Freeman from Office of Legislative Counsel. As I understand it, the issue, home care agencies are requiring their home care workers to sign a non-compete, and then when the home care worker goes to try to become employed by another person, they get a cease and desist order. So this was originally, Senate Bill 949 was intended to address that issue. However, I don't really think that it does what it's supposed to do, because the non-compete is not really the issue. 653-295 says you can only have a non-compete under certain circumstances. There are four things listed, and all of them have to be true. And one of them is that the individual is engaged in administrative, executive, or professional work who performs predominantly intellectual, managerial, or creative tasks, exercises discretion and independent judgment, and earns a salary. So I think that probably alone would say you couldn't do a non-compete. On the other hand...
Under existing law.
Pardon me?
Under existing law.
Yes.
Okay.
On the other hand, 653-295 says that it doesn't apply to a covenant not to solicit employees of the employer or solicit or transact business with customers of the employer. So that is probably what needs to be accepted instead of the non-compete provisions. And I understand that you have an amendment that does that.
Don't look at me.
Great. Kendall, do you want to...
Hi, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson. Yes, what Mrs. Freeman was just talking about with solicitation of employees.
And you need to say your name for the record, I'm sorry.
My name is Kendall Mason, and I'm a policy strategist for SEIU Local 503. We were a little bit concerned as well that the original language that came from LC around the non-compete wasn't quite touching on what we were seeing, which was this solicitation of employees and employers. And so we had the amendment drafted that seems to address exactly what Mrs. Freeman here was talking about.
And I know members had particular questions after the hearing before, and so now is the time.
Yeah, I do. I have one. So basically, 949 without the amendment says that if the home care worker wants to go get another job, the home care employer can void that, avoid the ability for them to get another job someplace else?
Senator Gelser, Senator Olson, the bill was intended to allow the home care worker to go work for somebody else. As I said, there's the current law already says you can't have a non-compete with respect to people, any employment relationship, unless the person meets the employment relationship meets those four criteria, including, I mean, it's basically professionals.
Right.
So I don't think that the current statute would allow a non-compete anyways for a home care worker and a home care agency.
So the amendment's going to fix it?
So if I understand correctly, what the amendment does is it significantly changes the bill to address the problem, which is not so much having a non-compete, but not allowing the person to go and work for somebody else.
Senator Gelser, yes, there is the same statute that says you can't have a non-compete unless it meets those four criteria, says that it doesn't apply to covenants not to solicit other employees. So that's really the loophole that the home care agencies could be using. And so as I understand it, the Dash 1 amendment then addresses that loophole.
Is this a major problem?
Vice Chair Olson, Chair Gelser, it is actually a major problem. I've had conversations with various home care workers who've experienced it, and I've actually had several conversations with people at the Oregon Home Care Commission who are aware that a lot of agencies are using these.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Pickle?
Yeah. you're using the word agencies, but are we just talking about home care businesses? I mean, we're not talking about state agencies, right?
Yeah, Senator Knope, members of the committee, yes, that's correct. When we say agencies, we are talking about home care agencies. They are private businesses.
Okay. And so I'm trying to understand the problem. So the problem is that these businesses are having employees sign covenants that they're not going to be solicited, or they're not going to solicit employment elsewhere?
So if you look at Senator Knipp, members of the committee, if you look at some of the materials from last week's committee hearing, there are cease and desist letters that folks have gotten, and in addition, a non-compete agreement that a worker was asked to sign. And so basically, it's what happens typically is a worker will work for a home care agency and make about $10.80 an hour and not have access to benefits. And then they'll learn, if I go work for the Oregon Home Care Commission, I can make more money per hour and have access to health care benefits. And so oftentimes the worker will be like, I'm going to do this for myself because it's a way for me to move up economically. It's made me a living wage. And so they'll tell their clients, I'm leaving. I'm going to go now work for the Oregon Home Care Commission because I can make a living wage and have access to health care. And their consumers are allowed to stay where they want. Part of Medicaid is consumer choice. They choose to choose from whom and from where you receive your services. If that consumer decides to leave and stay with their caregiver, who they've probably built a rapport with at this time or by this time, both of them are often slapped with cease and desist orders for stealing workers and or employees from the agency.
Follow-up question? Nope. All right, any other questions? Well, we've got folks here, and Lori, thanks for coming in at the last minute. Are people comfortable moving this today, or do you want another day?
No, without the amendment.
Well, we've got the amendment.
Really?
We've got the Dash 1 amendment.
Oh,
it's
do?
In Olas, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Let's wait for next meeting.
Okay. So we will carry this over to Wednesday. And so I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 949. And we're going to go with the bill that has only one person signed up for it. So that we can move through more things quickly. I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1027.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1027 permits the transfer of ABLE accounts account funds to the estate of a deceased designated beneficiary or to another eligible individual. It prohibits DHS and OHA from seeking payment from ABLE accounts. The measure restricts Oregon 529 Savings Networks, Oregon 529 Savings Board, board members, and the state of Oregon from insuring or guaranteeing a rate of return on ABLE accounts contribution and limits liability to those entities for losses. It specifies designated beneficiaries or of higher or of qualified higher education accounts made direct investment contributions or earnings by selecting between offered investment options. It declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Great, thank you. David Bell.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, thank you very much. For the record, my name is David Bell. I'm the Managing Director of the Oregon 529 Savings Network. This is the portion of the state treasury that manages the Oregon College Savings Plan and now the new ABLE Savings Plan. I am here to testify in support of Senate Bill 1027, and which I can get to in just a minute. I was hoping to just briefly give a little bit of background on ABLE, which I think is going to be really helpful for us. ABLE stands for Achieving a Better Life Experience. It was passed federally at the end of 2014, and thanks to Chair Gelser and many others in their support here in the state of Oregon, passed Senate Bill 777 in 2015, which allowed us to establish the Oregon ABLE Savings Plan. The disability community has been fighting for ABLE for close to a decade, and let me explain why. As many of you know, people with disabilities often rely on state and federal benefits, and many of those benefits come with asset limits, most of them around $2,000. So in order to stay on those benefits that they find so important, they need to keep their assets under $2,000, which has been very difficult. ABLE allows states to establish ABLE plans where people with disabilities and their families can save money without losing those benefits, which has been key. Here in Oregon, we launched our plan at the beginning of, or, I'm sorry, the end of 2016, and we've done extremely well. To date, or as a couple weeks ago, we had over 450 accounts, over $1 million in assets, showing us that families have been waiting for us, and now they're utilizing this, and all of this money is for their future disability related needs. We've been seen nationally as the ABLE plan. We were the sixth to launch. Now there's about 18 ABLE plans throughout the country. We've gained notoriety for being the ones that provide the most resources and support to the individuals that utilize it, because it was always supposed to be a financial empowerment tool. I say that because I just need to give a lot of accolades to an incredible working group made up of people with disabilities and the community organizations that helped launch this plan through a working group. I say all of this and give this background to simply say we'll work hard to remove any roadblocks that might be in the way of people with disabilities being able to save for their future. ABLE was a huge roadblock removed for individuals, but we're still seeing opportunities to improve and to continue to stay competitive. One of these would be addressed in Senate Bill 1027. The federal law for ABLE allows states to recover some funds if there are funds left in an ABLE account after the passing of an individual. So while we have the money in our hands in these ABLE accounts, they're in trust that Medicaid could not touch because it has to do with the different types of trusts that we have, and they're considered a creditor. This all has to do about when the money gets back into the estate of the family. And this is the key aspect here. Although Medicaid recovery is not foreign to many people that have disabilities and their families, ABLE is slightly different. ABLE is not only housing funds that are put into those accounts from the beneficiary themselves, from the individual with the disability. Families, extended family, friends, community in general want to put money into ABLE plans to allow people to be able to reach their dreams and meet their goals. And so one of the issues here is that through this process, upon the death of that beneficiary, not only the funds of that individual, but of all the money that was coming in from others would be subject to Medicaid Medicaid recovery, and we're finding that to be a roadblock. Families want to put more in to help those individuals. Maybe when they're not around, they're worried about doing so because of this piece. So the state of Oregon, and then many other states. In fact, there's 15 other states that are working to have similar legislation. And then on the federal side, there's some nonprofit organizations like National Disability Institute, National Down Syndrome Society, that are trying to work on a federal fix to this, but that's going to take some time. So we really want to be innovative here. We want to be able to provide more opportunities, less roadblocks for people with disabilities, and that's why we support this bill. And I'm happy to answer or try to answer any questions that you might have.
And can you speak to the amendment and the work that you've done with APD and the Department of Human Services?
Yes. So there's actually, I believe, two amendments, maybe one. I'll defer and find out. But one amendment would allow specifically, excuse me, Chair Gelser, would be allowing a slight change. The amendment would change it to where, and believe me, we can get the information if I can. DHS wanted us to put a little amendment in there so that it did not require the state to go against some sort of a federal regulation. So the small amendment was just basically saying where feasible for the state, not going against federal legislation, to be able to recover these funds. Did I answer your question, Senator Gelser?
Chelsea, do you want to? I just know it's important to DHS that we get this on the record the right
way.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, Chelsea.
Yeah. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, my name is Chelsea Broussard. I'm the policy director at the Oregon State Treasury. Chair Gelser, the Dash 1 amendments address some of our other concerns, but the concerns that DHS had did not make it into the Dash 1 amendments, and so they've requested a second amendment.
And do you have the note that you need for that? Is that ready to go?
We do not have the note yet, but we would love one.
All right, so maybe you can work with Matt after the hearing to get that, and then it'll go back to him quickly so we can get it here.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Are there other questions for
You know,
these
notes
folks?
Cost $5.
Questions? Them. Great. Well, we'll wait for those amendments to come back, and then we'll get it scheduled.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And thanks for the excellent work getting this rolled out. It's been really impressive to see, and people are pretty excited about it out there.
Thank you very much.
Right. Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1027 and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1024.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1024 requires a county to allow the siting of accessory dwelling units in areas zoned rural residential. It prohibits a county from adopting ordinances that restricts from siting an accessory dwelling unit in an area zoned rural residential. There is a statement of no revenue impact, and let me just double check. At the moment, we don't have a fiscal statement back yet.
Okay, yeah. Thank you. Before we start, Senator Montes Anderson, did you want to?
Yes, thank you. This bill came to me from a longtime friend, Mike McKeel, who will be testifying. And I'd rather just have him come forward and let us know what he would like.
Very good. Thank you. Mr. McKeel.
My name is Mike McKeel, and I also hail from Gresham, as Senator Montes Anderson does. My concern has been punctuated lately by, especially in Multnomah County, the lack of affordable housing that exists. And it even goes to my family. My daughter is a mental health social worker, and if I didn't help her with her rent, she'd be probably living in her car, mm-hmm. or, you know, whatever. She's got some health problems. And when we look at all the things we can do to help with housing, this is something that I think has been disallowed in Multnomah County based mostly on bias and not on by science. Accessory dwellings in rural areas occur all over the world. Almost every county in Washington allows them. I think the thing that people worry about is if you allow an accessory dwelling, somebody's going to plop a 40-year-old single-wide mobile home in their front yard, and that, you know, it's going to ruin the neighborhood. The thing about it is that these can be done in a way that are small, that are accessible, that can meet sanitary requirements, can meet storm crane requirements, and actually be an asset to the rural area and not a detriment. I've been a design review commissioner for the city of Gresham for 12 years now, and I sit in judgment of Type 3 land use hearings. And more the professional planners who used to be opposed to these, even in urban areas, now welcome them, and it's become a part of most urban planning plans in and around Multnomah County now. But I think the thing that prompted me to ask Senator Montes Anderson to sponsor a bill to allow these and to require the county to allow them, that they be done in a way that there is codes that restrict things from that make these to where they are not objectionable, where they're actually, I mean, garden cottages can be designed. I've won awards for designing innovative housing for, I don't know, 30 years, and I know how it's supposed to be done. It can be done. The Design Commission at Gresham, we've actually opened our codes up that if you have an innovative way to provide housing, you can do that if you show that it meets the intent of the codes that require that done. So I think the thing, getting back to why it prompted me, Multnomah County tightened up the restrictions on accessory dwellings to say that you could be cited and fined for putting a bed in your garage. And when I listened to these people here in the pink shirts, I thought this could be a godsend to not only the people that I think, but it could be godsend to anybody to be able to have a small independent housing unit that is incorporated into an existing home. I've lived in my house for 42 years, and they've existed. I think Gresham's allowed them for 10 years. I have never seen one that I even know exists. And I think all the reasons that might be objectionable to some people who want to restrict building in the rural areas, I think, can all be answered by good codes. And I think these should be allowed under very tight restrictions. And in rural residential areas, they don't have to be in every rural zone. They don't have to be in the rural reserves. But I think we have the same problem in the rural area. There's people that need housing that can't get it. And it's a tragedy around Portland that you can't rent anywhere for less than $1,200 a month. And I think as time has come, and I think it's time to change the thoughts on this and to not be just getting high blood pressure over these things that really don't need to be, you know, hurting people. So I'd be glad to answer any questions you
have.
Thank
you. Are there any questions?
The main concern is, I think, quality and sanitation, the quality of the unit and sanitation. And you're saying that these accessory dwelling units, the counties or the cities would need to develop codes they would develop codes to make sure that.
Yeah, they, first of all, they could be no more than 30% of the size of the other one. They'd be built in the same architectural style as the other ones. Right now, the county allows shipping containers to be used for storage buildings. And if people are worried about, you know, aesthetics in the rural area, those are about as unaesthetic as I can imagine. But, the sanitation, stormwater, everything that must be addressed in an urban area needs to be proven scientifically, not just any way else, that it can be handled. Once it can be handled, it's just a matter of having a little airspace. My daughter doesn't want to get married this summer and live in the bedroom next to our bedroom in a house, you know, so she can afford to live it. If she could live in a little garden cottage out beside my house, most people wouldn't know it was there. And I don't know if anybody objects to it. And I can tell you that almost every planner that I know, and I deal with them on a weekly, daily basis, are in favor of it. There's a few people who aren't, and they just feel that these are going to be it's going to be a real problem in rural areas, and I don't think it is, because it exists other places and it's not a problem.
Senator Olson.
Thank you very much. Being a builder myself, I'm a little bit concerned as to the building codes we have to meet all the time.
Yeah.
Sanitation would be, if the building was separated, You'd probably have a problem with fall on the existing sanitary line, so you probably have to put in a pump station to get it
up
to move it.
Well, yeah. Right now, I've got a little cottage that I own down by the Sandy River, and I didn't think, and it's got a cesspool. I didn't think there's any way you could put a, and it's a rocky site, but some of the new systems, they cost about $22,000, you know, but some of them you can do it in a really small area, and they work just great. We just built a fire station out at Fire District 10 out in East Multnomah County, and we used one of these systems out there, and it takes up, you know, like one-tenth the space of the old sand filter. And I've done cottage projects, and I've won awards for them, you know, and, you know, 700-square-foot small homes. And they don't have to be, something that really is, you know, something that's obnoxiously bad looking, and they don't. But you can do the sanitation. You can do the stormwater. There's probably more room to do sanitation and stormwater in the country than there is if you tried to put one in the city. And I just think it's an idea whose time has come, and it's an idea that has existed for two centuries or more all over the world. I mean, you travel in Europe, almost every house out in the country has a guest house. Some of them have a church on the property, you know, for the family. So I think, I understand the environmental issues that some people are concerned about, and I'm glad to sit down and work with anybody who has those concerns and try to do it, but it needs to be based on fact, not on bias. And I listened to testimony when I was out at the county from some of these people up in the West Hills that think, you know, these things are going to be rented for Airbnbs, and there's going to be guys having fraternity parties, and there's going to be beer cans all over the neighborhood. And that's not the truth. I have seen these done, and that is not the case. And it's just strictly, like I say, it's bias, and it's not true.
Would these structures, these 700-square-foot structures, are they kind of like the teeny houses? Are they going to meet all the code requirements? Or
oh, yeah.
They get exceptions?
I got some pictures on my phone I can show you. Salish Pond Cottage, Portland, yeah. I'll take you out to my project. I did 10 houses on 2,000-foot lots, and they're about 700 square feet. And I can't tell you how many architectural awards I've won for them. But the design and the way they're built and everything, you know, they work. And with housing shortages, my God, you know, I can't imagine how you can't at least take a look at them. I know my wife just retired as county commissioner, and her word from Kim Peoples, who is one step above, she told me that he favors them. But I think the planning director at Multnomah County, you know, kind of has had a little bit of a problem, you know, accepting the fact that they might work.
Right. Any other questions?
I'd like to bring up the other people, because I know there are some people that want amendments to the bill to make it where they could go neutral, and so it'd be nice to hear the others, and then
be great.
Okay, right. I'm fine with that. Yes.
All right, thank you very much. So next up, I have Becky Steckler, Mark Nystrom, and Jed Tompkins. And we've got about 10 minutes left and three more people, so maybe about 2 minutes each. Does that...
Great.
Thank you.
Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee, my name is Becky Steckler, and I'm with the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. And currently, we do not support the bill as written. We believe it is a pretty significant departure on Oregon land use planning. And really, for the amount of time, effort, and resources that we put into our urban growth boundaries, that it really requires us to define what is urban and keep that inside of urban growth boundaries and keep what is rural outside of urban growth boundaries. And we believe that there is the potential for significant increase in housing units outside of urban growth boundaries through this bill. And it's hard to get that kind of information, and I know I've asked around to the Department of Land Conservation and some of the counties. But for example, I know just with casual conversations with Clackamas County that they have about 18,000 dwelling units right now in the rural residential. And so it gives you, even if only a portion of those then develop ADUs, then it gives you a sense of there really is a potential for significant new residential uses outside of urban growth boundaries. And so it really kind of fuzzies that fuzzes that line between urban and residential. I would say also that it makes future urbanization much more challenging. There was a study done about a year and a half ago by the University of Oregon, and they looked at what happens when you bring, among other things, rural residential land into UGBs and then annexed into a city. And they found that once the lot goes from about 2 acres or less, that within the study period that they were looking at, about 20 years, that it really doesn't redevelop at urban densities. And so it kind of calcifies this sprawling type development. If you have lower densities, when you bring that into the urban growth boundary, it's much easier for it to subdivide and then redevelop at what you would expect to see inside of a city. So it just makes that a little bit more challenging. Also, cities and counties often have urban growth management agreements for that area that's inside the UGB but still hasn't been annexed to the city yet to try to preserve that ability to easily redevelop once it is actually brought into a city. I would say also, I know that a lot of folks are concerned, and naturally so, because Oregon communities are definitely facing an affordable housing crisis. But I would say that you're doing, in part, trading off some of those housing costs for transportation costs. I looked into the Housing and Transportation Index, which is a pretty robust site online where you can compare different places and how much it would cost for housing and transportation. And I compared where I grew up in Central Oregon in the Plainview area, about 15 miles outside of Bend, compared to where my sister now lives on the east side of Bend. And it's about an additional $5,000 per year for transportation costs alone for living out there. And that pretty much, I would say, works well with the experiences I had, where all four of the members in my family ended up having a car by the time my sister and I were teenagers. And that definitely increased the costs of getting us around. And then finally, I would say that the conversations we've had with planners across the state, as well as the Farm Bureau and Department of Agriculture, when you are increasing the population, the residential population, in those unincorporated areas, especially that are close to productive farmland and forest land, that you just do see so much more conflicts between those residences and others that are trying to use those rural roads. That said, I could go on. But that said, if this is a bill that's going to move forward, we definitely would love to see some sideboards that would limit, because the current legislation doesn't limit the size of the ADU or even defined accessory, and that would be, I think, very helpful, as well as making sure that it complies with and minimizes the impact on water quality and air quality and other things as well.
Thank you very much. And I really do have to ask you to keep it to about 2 minutes. Thank you.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Mark Nystrom with the Association of Oregon County. I would say that for the most part, we don't disagree with Mr. McKeel. There's a couple of things that we have an issue with that at this point puts us in opposition. The two points that are highly important to us is it must be permissive. A county has to be able to choose to take this path if they want to. And we shouldn't be preempting counties from making those decisions. The reason is that one of the things that were repeated was that there is a code amendments and plan updates. Those cost money. And for some counties, the way the bill is written right now, they would have to go through this process anyway. We don't feel that that's necessary. Last week, we have a bill just like this one over in the House side. We're asking for ADUs on rural residential areas. And we got some pushback on that. And so we had a small work group. There were some sideboards that were suggested. I'm going to read through them really, really quickly right now. The county should be able to impose any additional conditions. So besides these sideboards, they should be able to add to them. It was mentioned that the lot should be at least 2 acres. There were people who said even larger than that. It has to be on the same lot or same parcel as the existing home, either be attached to or located within, let's say, 100 feet. Other people said 50 feet of the existing home. Have a maximum size or be within the actual footprint of the existing home. Make sure that it obtains all permits necessary to safety, sanitation, and quality and durability of materials. the owner can demonstrate that there's adequate safe drinking water available, that it must not be situated in an area that's designated urban reserve, and if it's a detached. If it's detached, the county must coordinate with the city. If it's within 1 mile of the UGB, when it's a population of 10,000, or within a half mile of a UGB, if it's over than 10,000. But we'd be happy to share these. Senator Montes Anderson's office has been great, and we'll just continue to work with her.
Great. Thank you very much.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Jed Tompkins, Assistant Multnomah County Attorney, here on behalf of Multnomah County, and I'll be very brief because these two preceding me really covered what I was going to say. I really want to just point out that this isn't a simple change. This is a really big shift in direction from how these areas, these rural residential areas, have been planned over the last number of decades. They often don't have shoulders on the roads. There aren't public sewers. There aren't public water supplies. And this bill would essentially authorize a doubling of residential uses in an area where we've been directing that use actually inside towards the cities, right? So not to these areas, but inside where there are all those infrastructural services and where it actually makes more sense. And that's the affordable housing part of this last point. Is simply what Ms. Stickler said. I would challenge the notion that we are creating affordable housing by putting ADUs out in the rural areas where we lack this infrastructure. People are further away from the services they might need if they're folks that are in need of affordable housing.
Thank you very much. And before doing questions, just so we can get everybody up, I'm going to pull the next panel. All right, thank you. John Chandler, Mary Kyle McCurdy, and Carol Cheserek.
But I want a good crack at this guy.
Take a number.
John, why don't you go ahead and kick it off, since we're...
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association. We've been working with a group of people on this patch of bills, both the Senate Bill 1024 and three or four on the House side, trying to get our collective heads around the issue of accessory dwelling units, auxiliary dwelling units, what to do with these various issues that obviously a lot of people are concerned about. Other speakers have already talked about what's going on, but I thought I'd walk through very quickly at least the proposal that we floated as a way of squaring the circle with regard to ADUs, and that is to, as already indicated, leave it in the county's hands, that this be permissive, so a county could do this or not, and then to put some sideboards up that kept some of the environmental and land use impacts to a minimum, such as not allowing them inside of urban reserve areas where we've already designated the boundaries going to move at some point, and leaving it up to the within a certain geographic radius yet to be determined, leaving it up to the city and county to discuss, because even in areas without urban reserves, that's a statutory process that Metro and about four or five other cities have used. There still are, any city knows where they're likely to expand their boundary in the future, and have a conversation with the county so that, as was indicated, you don't end up with a further low-density ring around the city limits or the boundary when it does expand, making it that much more difficult to develop to urban densities. To require that the units be smaller than the house to which they are, if they're detached, make it smaller than the house to which they are accessory. To talk about groundwater limited areas, put some burden there on the property owner to make sure there is, in fact, sanitary water available to the property. Then have them some distance requirement between a detached unit. If we're talking about fixing up the attic or the basement, that doesn't really matter, or adding a wing to a house. But if you're moving setting up a separate structure, having some proximity there so you're not just creating, again, more development out in areas where it's going to be more difficult. Those kinds of sideboards, I think, are the ones that have been raised in trying to address the implications that make it more intense urban use of property, perhaps in the future, more difficult, and also address some of the environmental concerns that have been raised. We would commend whether this bill or the others. I'm frankly agnostic as to which ones move forward. I think the content is going to be far more critical, with all due respect to the authors, than the bill numbers at this stage of the proceedings.
All right. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Chair Gelser and members of the committee. Mary Kyle McCurdy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. We oppose Senate Bill 1024, and I'm going to talk about a few of the reasons why that I think inform the types of discussions that John just described that we are having, that we're part of on this whole constellation of bills. First of all, Senate Bill 1024 is not actually about accessory dwelling units. We keep calling them accessory dwelling units, but they're defined as can be a detached permanent structure of independent living quarters, just another house on the same lot. And there's no requirement for affordability or any size restriction relative to the existing house, none of that. It's just another house on a lot. And as you've heard people say, that could potentially double the number of homes on rural residential areas in the state. And just to paint a picture of what that is, there are 708,000 acres of land zoned for rural residential uses outside urban growth boundaries in the state. Yes, that's over 700,000 acres. Inside urban growth boundaries, we have a little over 800,000 acres. We have a tremendous amount of land outside urban growth boundaries that's available today for rural residential development. This is not about a lack of opportunity to live in a rural residential area. But these areas vary widely across the state. Some are one home per 2 acres, some are one home per 20 acres, because that allow density depends on a variety of things, including the groundwater capacity, septic capacity, wildfire risks, whether they're in a wildlife habitat area or migration routes. To uniformly allow another dwelling on every lot is a very broad brush approach. The conflicts that poses with the farming and agriculture and ranching that goes on, that these areas are often in the midst of. And as you've heard others describe, among other things, it increases trespass onto farm and forest land, but also it increases the commuting, whether it's by those who are engaged in short-term rentals going to and from the rental, or those commuting into nearby towns for jobs. So we oppose the bill as written. We are part of the group that John Chandler described that is seeing if there can be reasonable sideboards on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ooh, two microphones. Hi, I'm Carol Cheserek. I own and live a property in a rural residential zone in the Tualatin Mountains in western unincorporated Multnomah County. For many years, my neighborhood's worked hard to preserve the farms and significant wildlife habitat in these hills and to get that area preserved in a rural reserve. I'm here opposing Senate Bill 1020, and I hope it won't be endorsed by the committee, certainly not in its current form. I was astonished to learn that this bill would require counties to allow ADUs on rural residential properties, even in rural reserves, and that the bill explicitly prohibits enforcement of thoughtful science-based restrictions on building locations and uses in those RR zones, blocking rules that protect natural resources, farm and forest uses, livability, and rural character. This is not about liking aesthetics of a new dwelling. It's about preserving farm and forest uses and natural resources. Multnomah County just finished an extensive revision of our comp plan that was driven by an all-citizen advisory committee, people who live in these rural areas and know how things work. The Senate bill would undermine all those policies and protections. It would allow a property owner, an existing home, to add a dwelling unit without restriction on the size, location, or use, as long as you meet codes. There's nothing affordable about this. An accessory dwelling unit, as I read this bill, could have 10 or more bedrooms, all of which could be high-end overnight Airbnb rentals, effectively creating a hotel. It could include a retail store, a winery, a day spa, maybe even a factory if you put your bedroom in a corner of it. Since the county is not allowed in this bill to restrict the uses of the ADU. This is just crazy. This bill also eliminates any local voice in how these dwelling units could be used or where they could be placed. Squeezing these added units in on these 5-acre rural residential lots, we've got steep slopes, tons of headwater streams. All that habitat's going to be fragmented if you add all these additional dwellings.
I'm going to have to ask you to summarize.
Yep. I think that's it. We really don't like it. I love the idea of ADUs. I think they're wonderful in urban areas. I hope you can find ways to encourage them in urban areas where they're actually helpful.
All right. Thank you very much. And last up, we have Mark Greenfield.
Well, he's coming up.
Very brief last word.
Yeah, my staff's been really working a lot with AOC, 1,000 Friends, counties, the home builders, and it doesn't matter whether it's this bill or the ones on the House side, but I really am excited about the possibility of getting something through as long as everyone is fairly happy.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I'm Mark Greenfield. I live on a approximately 13-acre farm on Salvi Island where we raise sheep. I've got a number of concerns about this bill. First, it really strikes me more as a land use bill than a human services bill. The people who need affordable housing also need convenient transportation, medical, social, emergency services, shopping, and the like. Our house is right near the bridge on Salvi Island. We're still a 25-minute walk to the nearest bus stop and a 7-mile drive to the nearest supermarket. So these accessory dwelling units, whatever you want to call them, really are not convenient in rural areas. As to the comment that I believe Mr. McKeel made that they wouldn't be used for Airbnbs, there was a letter submitted by a neighbor of mine, Cindy Reed, into the record of your proceeding that indicated that she counted 16 Airbnb ads in the Salvi Island area for these kinds of units. That included our next-door neighbor, and people who used the units of our next-door neighbor trespassed onto our property. People were standing right at our sheep gate. Had they let them out, they could have been injured, or the sheep could have been injured, and it would have been our liability. Secondly, this bill is ambiguous. It doesn't say Multnomah County has an exclusive farm use zone, a rural residential zone, a mixed-use agriculture zone, which is what I live in, and a rural center zone. Is this limited just to the rural residential zone, or is it broader than that?
And I have to ask you to summarize. Unfortunately, the clock is not on our side right now.
Okay. I do want to make just a few more points. First of all, the land use program has been in place for 45 years, and it directs housing inside urban growth boundaries. That is the appropriate place for ADUs. I think this bill would promote rural sprawl at the cost of livability and service efficiency and rural character. And finally, as you've heard from a number of people, it has to be left, if any of this use is allowed, it has to be left discretionary with the judgment of the affected of the local officials and not just forced on the counties and the people who live in those counties. Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. And with that, thank you all for being patient and staying. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1024, and we're adjourned. Public hearing on Senate Bill 1024, and we're adjourned.